On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Welcome to a very special On the Bookshelf in time for Veterans Day. Today, our special guest is Lieutenant Colonel William Bill O'Connor, U.S. Air Force retired, who logged 6,077 jet flight hours as fighter, test, and instructor pilot before retiring. That included flying the F-117 stealth fighter in the NATO bombing campaign over Kosovo in 1999. His new book is Stealth Fighter, A Year in the Life of an F-117 Pilot from Zenith Press. Colonel, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to On the Bookshelf today.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Now, you flew for the Air Force for 26 years. You flew the F-16. You flew 79 combat sorties over Iraq during the no-fly zone years. Before you started flying F-117s, the F-117 is an airplane that it is a very odd-looking airplane, and from your description of it, flying it was not like flying a usual airplane either. Essentially, you're flying inside the airplane and not really able to look out personally. You're flying it through a monitor and through instruments.
Pretty unique aircraft designed to operate solely at night. We did fly in the daytime, of course, but the primary mission was at night. So pretty much every time we looked outside, I have little quotes around the word looked. We were looking for an infrared sensor. Like I say, we were kind of the brains inside of the machine versus a pilot flying a more traditional aircraft.
Now, you had known about the F-117 before you ever had a chance to fly it.
For a few years, certainly. A long time ago, when I was a F-16 pilot in Miami, Florida, at Homestead Air Force Base, that was about the time the aircraft had first been announced to the public. Pilots of my generation kind of knew there was something going on out there in the desert, but we really didn't have a good handle on what it was. And, of course, we weren't really encouraged to speculate openly. So late 80s, when it was publicly announced and we could ask questions openly, we started asking, how do you get into a program? Where did the pilots come from? And we kind of learned the culture of how the whole program had spun up initially. I flew F-16s for several years, didn't exchange to the Navy, ended up in EF-111s for a few years. And it was really kind of towards the end of my career. I'd been in for 17 years by then. I really kind of wanted to take one last shot at something unique. You know, the 117 community had openings at the time, which is a little bit rare. It was a very small community, so the turnover was fairly small. The timing worked out well, and in June of 1998, I was assigned to Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico and started training out there.
Yeah, essentially, you're flying an airplane that is, when under proper conditions, essentially invisible.
Very close to it. We were never truly invisible to radar. We were just less observable. The early days, if the press chose to call us invisible, that was a method we were more than happy to encourage. But we knew we were never perfectly invisible. But we were infinitely smaller on radar than any of the other aircraft in the inventory. So when there was a specialist mission against a high radar threat environment, generally we would go in first. Essentially knock down some doors, turn off some radars to allow the more conventional aircraft to sweep in. But like I say, we were never truly invisible. We had our vulnerabilities, and they were just narrower than a more conventional aircraft.
It's fascinating to read about what it's like to be inside an airplane in the first place. For those of us who have never flown an airplane, much less an aircraft like this, it's a pretty extraordinary thing to hear about it firsthand. One of the things I enjoyed about your book is that at the beginning of each chapter, you have a clever quote here. The ultimate responsibility of every pilot is to fulfill the dreams of his countless millions of earthbound ancestors who could only stare skyward and wish. And for all of us who wear glasses and all the things that kept us from being pilots once upon a time, to get a chance to find out a little bit of what it's like to be encased in a machine like this is quite an amazing experience. When we see old World War II movies and see people flying in the B-24s and later on in B-52s and so forth, and the kind of flight suits that these guys wore, from the description in your book, A Stealth Fighter, the type of flight suits you guys wear in an F-117 was considerably different.
Compared to the World War II years, very much so. In World War II, a pilot and his crew would walk out to a machine, if it was good weather, wearing their uniforms. Just they'd have ties and, lace-up shoes, and eventually they learned to pull a set of coveralls over the top of that. Usually made out of cotton. course, fire in the air is always a hazard. So slowly over the years, we came up with some fireproof suits or fire-resistant suits called Nomex suits that we would wear. And, of course, the tie and uniform under the coveralls quickly went away. And, you know, so now a pilot, if he's wearing anything other than a flight suit, he feels out of place for the most part.
Well, and also there are a number of layers that you're wearing, fireproof layers and so forth, that you described before you entered the cockpit of the F-117.
Depending on the mission, if it was a long overwater mission, we wear an anti-exposure suit, which is essentially kind of a loose and baggy scuba diving suit. That would be underneath the Nomex layer, so it itself would be protected against fire. Obviously, in cold weather, there would be layers of thermal long underwear, essentially, underneath the rubber suit, and for comfort. Of course, in order for any of this to be even remotely comfortable, there'd be a thin layer of cotton suits and gloves under all that mess. And if we were practicing to operate in a chemical warfare environment, then there would be additional layers of carbon-infused garments that would go over the top of that and special filters on your mask. And during the Coast World War, typically we flew suits that weren't a whole lot different than when anybody in an F-16 or an A-10 would be flying. Because the temperature, and we were flying over water, usually several layers of thermal clothes, our Nomex flight suits and jackets. And there'd be a pilot's G-suit on top of that, which allows a pilot at high speed and high Gs to maintain consciousness a bit better. A typical helmet, oxygen mask, you'd have a survival vest over the top of that with all sorts of goodies like your survival gear and radios and a pistol and whatever. And of course, if it's cold, you put another coat on top of that. So towards the end, by the time you walked out to the airplane in the winter, you kind of looked like a green Pillsbury doughboy.
I it's funny. For those of us who have never flown, I guess we always assumed that an airplane was like a car in the wintertime, that you just crank up the heater and you could fly in your shirt sleeves or in a compression suit, but nothing more than that. But you guys are flying very high, and there really isn't space to waste on something like a heater in a cockpit of an airplane, is there?
Yes and no. Yes, there was an air conditioner, and there are heaters in the cockpit. But there's a phrase our life support guys would always used to use, and that was dress to regress. You always had to work on the assumption that sometime during this flight, things are not going to go well, and you may be hanging underneath the parachute. And if that were the case, what would you like to be wearing?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Even if you were in your car and you knew for an absolute fact that you were going to roll into a snowbank in 20 minutes, you'd probably put on something more than a T-shirt.
Right. That, which, by the way, is a pretty good idea, because you hear every year about people who get stranded in their cars wearing light clothing because they think that they're going to be fine, and they do end up stranded in snowbanks, and then they've got a serious, serious exposure problem.
Well, I'll say also part of the gear was you wanted to wear your equipment. And if there was any reason you wanted or had to eject out of an aircraft, whatever's in your pocket and on your back is all that's going to go with you. And if you use the car and the snowbank analogy, well, you might be able to go around to the trunk and pull out whatever gear you had back there. But when you're in a parachute, if it wasn't in your pocket or in the vest, that's what you have.
Yeah.
So that was kind of your going in position that, you know, me and the airplane made part company at very short notice sometime during a combat mission. So anything you might want for the next few days has to be essentially attached to your body in some manner.
Right, and that's part of that. You wear a vest that, and you have incredible array of pockets that you have extra rounds for your sidearm and emergency radio and extra batteries for the radio and food and all sort first aid kit and all the sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Never enough pockets.
Always looking for one more place to put one more little thing. And if you're jumping out of an airplane, you don't really have time to check around and say, gee, I'd like to take this with me. You pretty much have to go right when the ejection seat says we're going now.
That's true. And also, an ejection is a very violent process. So unless it's, again, it's sewn to a vest or part of your body or really zipped into a pocket, you're likely to lose it in the violence of the ejection. So they're really going to grab things off the side and tuck them into pockets. We had one pilot, the only F-117 that was shot down in combat, was on the fourth night of the Coast Guard War. A good friend of mine, I just talked to him about a few weeks ago. But, you know, he talked about how violent the process was. He was flying his combat mission, paying attention to his line, thinking about his targets, and all of a sudden, you know, here come the missiles in a very bad zone, and he got hit, and then it was just some of the words he used to use, it kind of felt like a marble in a clothes dryer.
Yeah.
Bouncing around, tumbling end over end. And so the next tenth of a second of your life is solely devoted to getting out of this thing. You really don't have time to look around the cockpit and say, gee, it'd be nice if I had that extra, you know, ham sandwich tucked away in a pocket now. It's on you. What you have is what you get to keep.
There you go. We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel William B. O'Connor, U.S. Air Force retired, the author of Stealth Fighter, A Year in the Life of an F-117 Pilot from Zenith Press. Brad is contract instructor pilot and flies World War II warbirds for heritage organizations on weekends, which is pretty cool. In Pike County, we have one of the largest private collectors of vintage flyable World War II airplanes in the country, Wiley Sanders. And we, every once in a while, for parades or special events, we see somebody flying a Liberator or something like that. It's an amazing thing to see in the sky. The F-117 is not a fighter plane per se. I was surprised to read that, except for carrying these enormous bombs, it's not really designed to be a fighter plane.
Not at all. In fact, it's interesting. Every time this subject comes up, every 117 pilot has to spend, you know, a couple minutes explaining where the term came from. Specifically, in the United States and the Navy, in the Marine Corps, they will designate an aircraft based upon the mission that it flies. So an F-14 Tomcat was just a fighter. An F-18 that could be a fighter or an attack aircraft will be designated an F-A, F-18, and so on. By those rules, the F-117 should have been called the A-117. It really was a baby bomber, a very small attack airplane. However, the Air Force has never really followed those conventions. It names a fighter based upon the airframe type. So if you have an F-16, it's an F-16. Even if it's carrying cargo, we'd still call it an F-16. That's just,
yeah.
More than anything else.
Well, and the F-117 has this radar absorbent material that's glued in sheets over the outside of it, which is what gives it its stealth characteristics. And I never thought about this, but when your bomb bay doors were open, you're right, all of a sudden, it's like a hole opens up in the sky as far as somebody who's targeting you, and there your underbelly is exposed because the doors are open that have the ram on them.
Exactly. The stealth characteristics of the airplane, a lot of it was created by the actual shape of the airplane, all the flat facets, we called it, and a significant portion was by the absorbing coating on the outside. Unfortunately, the coating on the outside, the technology at the time made that material fairly soft. It felt like hard rubber to the touch. The technology improved greatly since then, but that's what we had at the time, which kind of limited our speed a little bit.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But as you mentioned, as soon as you open the bomb bay door, you have a massive square aluminum box in the sky, which is a huge radar reflector, and we're as visible to the world on radar as anything else in the sky. So naturally, we plan our tactics carefully to minimize that exposure, minimize in what direction we're visible from, and of course to minimize the amount of time that the door was open. One of the more panicked events for a pilot in 117 was having the door stuck open.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very brief couple of, probably tenth of a second, seems like about an hour and a half. I thought one of my bomb bay doors had been had stuck in the open position right after attacking a target west of Belgrade one night. And like I say, you know, probably it was only about a tenth of a second or so. They're speeding an awful lot longer at the time.
Ooh, I can understand.
Because otherwise, we were undefended. We were, the whole point was to be invisible, and that was it. That's all we had. A description was called, we were a one-trick pony. We did one thing. We did that one thing better than anything else in the world. But at the end of the day, we only did one thing, and that was to be hard to find.
Yeah. The description of the time that you took fire while you were flying a mission in Kosovo, pretty harrowing. And I can understand you comment that later on, seeing fireworks of the 4th of July wasn't as exciting as it had once been, because not because it was boring, but because it reminded you of what it was like to be the person way up there that things were going off against. That's got to be another one of those, this seems like I'm up here for 3 hour kind of deals, even though it's just a matter of seconds.
Actually, the times we're being shot at, obviously had your full attention in the moment.
Yeah.
And there was one particular weapon the surgeon using, as near as I can tell, was 23-millimeter automatic cannon fire. But it had a little self-destruct function to it, and they go off, it looked like, just like a strobe light. And after the war, came back, got home just before the 4th of July in upstate New York, went to a field day with big 4th of July fireworks, and it was just glorious. And I kept staring at this just one part of the sky, and I just couldn't figure out why this window of display kept, you know, catching my eye, and then it occurred to me that's exactly what it looked like, only looking down instead of looking up. It was an interesting experience.
I would imagine so. We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Lieutenant Colonel Brad O'Connor, U.S. Air Force retired, the author of Stealth Fighter, A Year in the Life, an F-117 Pilot. It's from Zenith Press, which is an imprint of Quayside Publishing Group. You can check their website, zenithpress.com, for more information. Some of the pictures that are included here are really amazing, and I was astonished to see, and this is very, very cool, that the cockpit, you're just surrounded by instruments and gauges and readouts. And in another place in the book, you explain what all these little tiny things are that are all around you. I'm guessing that part of being what makes a fighter pilot, I have to be supremely confident in what you do, is that you're keeping track of all this stuff while you're, also trying to figure out where to drop bombs and try not to be shot down.
Well, of course, you know, we don't just jump into these in an afternoon. There's a lot of training. A typical fighter pilot would go through 6 to 10 months of training for an individual airplane, like an F-16 or an F-15. The 117 training was very much abbreviated. It was only about 2.5 months long, which would be ridiculously short, except the 117 only put very experienced people into its core to begin with, so we could abbreviate the plan a little bit. The systems were kind of halfway between the old round-gauge traditional cockpit instrumentation and the more modern integrated glass cockpit computer-driven instrumentation, so it's kind of a hybrid. And some of it was very advanced and some of it very modern, and other parts were, a guy from World War II would not have been uncomfortable looking at it. So it's kind of an interesting mix of the two. The airplane flew very stably when it was working properly at altitude, so it allowed you to monitor the systems quite a bit. And we usually flew by ourselves, so we didn't have to worry about maintaining formation positions and issues that an F-16 pilot might have to fly with. So it worked out. I enjoyed it. It was fun. It's, you know, part of every fighter pilot is that 8-year-old kid that never quite grew up. Like I say, you know, we like lots of pockets. We like stuff in our pockets. We like, you know, buttons and knobs and toys to play with. And this community, this airplane, was just a good fit for me.
Having flown the F-117 and prior to that having flown the F-16, obviously the difference in the mission of the airplane is different. But what else is particularly different? The F-16 is a fighter plane versus a small bomber, or is it more to it than that?
There's really not a whole lot in common. Ironically, the one thing they do have in common is the computer-driven flight control system was the same for each. The 117 was really, in a lot of ways, other than the exterior, very much an off-the-shelf airplane. The engines came out of F-18s. The flight control system was an F-16. The original navigation system came out of a B-52. So essentially, once Lockheed had built the outer frame, you know, the unique part, they just needed components that worked, and they just kind of borrow from every airplane out there. Getting back to the F-16B 117 comparison, yes, F-16, brilliant design, extremely maneuverable in terms of just visually fighting, looking out at a wonderful bubble canopy. It might be, still be, the very best pure dogfighter, you know, the United States has ever built. Having said that, it was designed to do a little bit of everything, whereas the 117 was designed to do one mission. So I don't know, it might be comparing in the medical field, you have a very refined specialist in brain surgery, but he really can't help you with a broken foot.
Right.
A general practitioner is maybe not brilliant at brain surgery, but he can do a little bit of everything. We're very much the specialist, whereas the F-16 really, other than hauling cargo, do everything invented out there and do it well.
Are there newer airplanes that are in use now that you can tell us about? Or I know there's always something in development, because we learned a lesson from the Germans, certainly during World War II, that they began the war with great airplanes but never really improved on them. And by the end of the war, the fact that they never really improved on them, other than experimental things, they never put anything into large-scale production, was a significant reason for the demise of the Luftwaffe. The United States Air Force, there's always something new on the horizon.
That's true. Again, the Germans had some brilliant experimental ideas, but they just really couldn't get them into mass production on a practical level.
Right.
their ME-262 jet, best airplane in the sky. But if you only have a handful against virtually tens of thousands of the opponent, it doesn't matter how good you are.
Yeah.
There are other airplanes out there. The F-16 is going to live a long life. The F-15 is going to probably be around for another 10 years or so. The F-22 is slowly supplanting part of the F-15's mission, but we built very few. There's only 183 that came off the line, so it's a very small community in itself. The F-35 is really the airplane the entire U.S. military is pinning its hopes on. It's going to replace virtually close to all the fighters in both the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps. It's kind of, we put all our eggs in one basket to a certain extent. Having said that, parts of that design are astounding. I have a good friend down in Fort Worth who's an engineer working on aspects of it. Cockpit integration, navigation, the displays a pilot can see are science fiction. Instead of actually having displays in the cockpit, the data is displayed right on the visor of his helmet. So as he turns his head left and right, he's bringing all his displays with him. He can actually aim the weapons and the guns and the radar by looking at something, and all the weapons turn and kind of keep track of where he's gazing. The engines are very powerful. The electronics, again, are just magical. Airplane's getting a little bit heavy, probably not as maneuverable as an F-16 was, but they also have some moderate stealth capabilities to them also. We have a lot of hope spent on the F-35 because there really isn't anything in development beyond that at the moment.
Well, it's an exciting to get a chance to talk to you about someone who's flown a plane that for almost a decade no one knew anything about except for you guys. And even after it was publicly acknowledged in, I think it was 88, there still weren't a whole lot of them that you ever saw, just like the Blackbird. We knew that the United States had them, that the Air Force was flying them, but it wasn't the kind of thing you expected to see because that was the whole point. And even more importantly, we didn't want the other guys to see us, which was even more the whole point. So you've kind of given us a little window into this extraordinary aircraft and the extraordinary men that flew them.
Yeah, and I allude to it a little bit in the early chapters. The early days, called them the Black Days, were very unique. Very few airplanes were built, only 59 operational, of which at any given time, only 40 of them were out there in the field.
Wow.
And that's two squadrons. So it's, you know, a couple dozen. In fact, at the end, I have a small appendix in the back of all the airplanes that flew, mm-hmm. their tail numbers when they first flew, and where they ended up, and most are in storage back where they started out in Tonopah, Area 52. So it's a small enough community that, you know, with little asterisks and, you know, an individual in 2 or 3 year period could fly a good 3/4 of the fleet. It's just a very small community. You kind of knew, the airplanes by tail number the same way you knew your friends. They were a small enough number that you kind of knew their quirks, and it was an interesting world. Now, not knowing about the airplane, that was a fascinating story in itself. For a good decade, this airplane was flying out at Tonopah, just north of the Nellis Ranges, under an area called Area 52. So if you believe in UFOs, they're right next door to Area 51. And for a decade, they would not leave the range. And the fear was if one were to crash, they didn't want somebody in a highway to stumble across this thing and see what it looked like. Because a lot of the secret was just in the shape of it. And of course, as soon as somebody saw it in the daylight, that would be given up.
Right.
And the fact that they could hide this for a decade with dozens of pilots cycling through working Monday to Friday, their families never knowing what was going on, was absolutely astounding. Then it came out in the middle phase, called the gray years. They're still up at Tonopah. They're still hidden away. But as you mentioned, 88, a few photos are published. The word's out that it's out there. And that made the life on the guys a lot easier because now they could fly in the daylight, but it wasn't that big of a secret anymore. They could tell their families where they were going. Imagine going home with the wife for a decade or so on every Friday and say, "Where were you all week?" "I can't tell you." Well, that adds up to a fair amount of stress.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah. And in the white years, we all moved to home, and we were kind of treated like every other airplane. You know, we went home at the end of every day, and you'd sit inside the airplane and have your picture taken.
Well, Brad, it's been a great honor to talk to you. I particularly was excited about getting a chance to visit with you for Veterans Day, and I think you might be the first I've been doing this show for 22 years, and I think you might actually be the first fighter pilot that I've had a chance to interview. Certainly the only fighter pilot I've interviewed who didn't fly, say, in Vietnam or in World War II. So this is really exciting to get a chance to talk to you and get a new generation of pilots and veterans, give our listeners a little bit of insight on you. Thank you so much for the book and for making time to talk to us.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk.
Do you have a website we can go to find out more about you?
Yeah, there's you can go to www.stealthfighter.info, a small website about the book. Of course, Amazon, Zenith Press have descriptions of the book. For those who are interested in the World War II stuff, you mentioned it quickly. We have a World War II group out in Frederick, Oklahoma, I belong to, for the World War II Airborne Demonstration Team. And our unique claim to fame is we are running the only World War II jump school in the country at this moment.
Well, that is interesting.
If you want to pretend you're in the Band of Brothers and go through 1943-style jump school and jump out of a C-47 five times, give us a holler.
Wow. Amazing. Don't be surprised if you get some calls from Alabama, that's for sure. Brad, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, sir.
Yes, sir. Once again, those websites, zenithpress.com,
stealthfighter.info, small website about the book.
And on behalf of all of us, we appreciate so much, the more than we could ever tell you. We appreciate you veterans and what you have done to stand between us and harm's way in order to keep our country free. May your sacrifices never be forgotten. Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless. On The Bookshelf, copyrighted by Kirby Creative Services, Inc., used by permission of Troy Broadcasting Corporation.